from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Over 100 works by Pablo Picasso are on display from Paris at the San Francisco de Young Museum. We will discuss the exhibition, which just opened this past Saturday, with the curator as we explore the extraordinary genius and productivity of Pablo Picasso. And you can see a slideshow of a number of the works in the exhibition simply by going to www.kqed.org/forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Saturday, a collection of some 150 paintings, drawings, sculptings, carvings, and other objects by Pablo Picasso on loan from the Musée National Picasso went on display at San Francisco's de Young Museum. And in this forum hour, we want to discuss the exhibit and the life and work of Pablo Picasso. Let me say that I saw the exhibit yesterday. The scope of it, the range of it is quite breathtaking. You really get the sense of not only the career of this extraordinary artist and his productivity, but really a lifetime of work from 1901 to 1970. Timothy Englund Burgard is the curator of American Art for the de Young Museum. He was the curator of this Picasso exhibit, and he joins us in studio. And good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Like I say, it's been less than 24 hours since you and I have seen each other. I came away from this. I'm still processing it because it is such an extraordinary exhibit. And I know people are anxious to see it and will see it in droves. But in some ways, I keep thinking of something that your boss, John Buchanan, said about how Picasso really transformed the definition of art.
Picasso really did. If you were an artist who came of age, as it were, artistically between about 1910 and 1960, you had to deal with Picasso. You had to confront his work. You could embrace it, reject it, but you had to deal with it. He's a towering figure. The history of Picasso's life and work is almost the history of modernism in art as we understand it. And so he's really a major figure. This exhibition makes that explicitly clear. I also think it's very timely. It's the greatest assemblage of Picasso's since the great centennial exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in 1981. And I think in retrospect, a lot of people would say, well, Picasso was the great artist of the first half of the 20th century. But I would say the last 50 years has really been dominated by the example of Warhol. And so I think it's a very opportune time to look back at both of their legacies. And I think like Warhol, Picasso's legacy was clouded by his celebrity. We can all picture those post-war Look in Life magazine exposés with him on the beach at Cannes or in the south of France. And he sort of became a larger-than-life figure while his work was neglected in the post-war years and he was seen as passé and retardataire.
But what you realize in seeing this exhibit is just how protean an artist he was and is. And not only that, but the sense of not only the range of what he could do, but you walk away from that thinking, boy, could he draw. I mean, he could really paint. He could really do the stuff. And he could sculpt and he could carve. I mean, in ways that are really extraordinary. It's the talent that's so suffused.
It's absolutely true. And it's interesting about Picasso. I think if we stopped all 10,000 people in there on a weekend at the de Young Museum watching or looking at the exhibit and asked them at the end, is Picasso your favorite artist or who's your favorite artist? Almost no one would probably say Picasso. I'm fascinated by the fact that almost no one picks him. And yet when you are confronted by the reality of these works, which, as you say, are so powerful, so compelling, so physical, they have a raw brutality, the scraping, scratching, erasures, the scumbling of the paint, the translucency, the transparency, you are forced by the sheer bravura power of his talent to deal with them as works of art that have their own reality. And that's one of the great experiences of this exhibition.
You also compelled with this exhibition realize the speed at which he moves, the artistic evolution. And he was always sort of ahead of himself, as I think you said when we were going through the exhibit, challenging himself, eating himself, cannibalizing on himself. But You walk into the exhibit and there are two works and they're just 2 years apart, and you just see that kind of vast difference that exists in terms of his evolution as an artist.
It's absolutely right. And the first work you're referring to is a beautiful outline portrait of his mistress at the time, Madeleine. And all she is, the total sum of her depiction is just a single line, as if he had put his charcoal down on the canvas, never lifted it until he had completed the outline of her. It's an extraordinary performance in which with a single line, he differentiates form from void and the figure from absence of figure or absence of content. It's really this protean aspect of Picasso that you just referred to, that with the ability, one of the great draftsmen in the history of all of art, to really define that. And then, as you say, 2 years later is the most abstract study for Demoiselle d'Avignon, the great icon of 20th century modernism, the greatest painting of the century, I would say. Georges Braque, his great friend and compatriot and colleague with whom he developed cubism, said, Demoiselle d'Avignon is a painting that looks like someone swallowed gasoline and spit fire.
There's so much of this association with Picasso and cubism, but I think, as we're intimating, there were so many different stages. I mean, he could do classic and did classic type of representational work, expressionistic work, surrealistic work. I mean, you see the whole gamut, and also the gamut of all the artists who influenced Picasso. I mean, Cezanne and Matisse particularly, but also Van Gogh and Gauguin. It's a whole art history lesson is really what it is.
It is. Picasso was famously an omnivore when it came to art. He also said very pithily, he said, you know, mediocre artists copy, great artists steal. And he certainly did. And one of the really wonderful ingredients or components of his art is that he embraces modern life in the way that Edouard Manet and Charles Baudelaire urged artists to do in the mid-19th century. But then he goes to the great history of art and the old masters and leavens these contemporary scenes with the timelessness. So for example, in the exhibition is a beautiful Rose period painting of two little boys who seem to be associated with the circus. Picasso loved the circus, skilled performers who have a public life and persona and then have a darker private life, and that's Picasso in his early years in Paris. But they're naked, so they have their circus drum, they have their begging bowl as if they're street performers, and yet he depicts them like Egyptian or Greek kuros figures. So he gives them this timeless aspect, which of course is one of the great sort of characteristics or hallmarks of artists, of great artists from the past.
Talking to Timothy Anglin Burgard, who is curator of American art for the D. Young Museum and was curator for the Picasso exhibit, which opened up on Saturday. Of course, when you talk about Picasso, and when you particularly, Timothy, talk about Picasso, you're talking often psychobiographically, you're talking about cultural and historical influences, and there are those who would say, well, let's just look at the art and let the art have its effect on us and all of those kind of arguments. And I'm wondering about just your sense of separating those two, or if they even need to be separated. Because one of the first things that I was struck by, as you know, when I was looking at some of those early works of his, was how Spanish and how Catholic they are. And it's difficult to separate that.
I absolutely agree. I think I understand why many people feel that the fascination with psycho-autobiography or biography in the last couple of decades has threatened to occlude the accomplishments of these great artists. And Picasso is not alone in that, of course. On the other hand, Picasso himself, going to the master, actually said, I paint the way other people keep their diaries. I actually date them to the day and often to the place because they really do reflect his autobiography. Having said that, I think you need to know his autobiography, but one of his great accomplishments is to take and start with that kernel of personal experience. It could be one of his mistresses or muses, for example, and then to universalize it, like all great writers, poets, musicians, and artists, to take it to a higher, deeper level.
More archetypal, really.
Exactly, yeah, and more universal about human experience. Picasso, at heart, deep down, is one of the greatest humanist artists of all time in the way you might think of someone like Rembrandt, an artist he admired very much. He really is interested in the human form and the human condition.
And he's also an artist who anthropomorphizes just about everything, as you pointed out. But you understand a lot, to mention the word muse, you understand a lot through the women that he became associated with, the women who were his lovers.
Absolutely. And this is, of course, an important component of these psychobiographies, is the women in his life have also threatened to obscure the works themselves. It's fascinating. I think that I've always thought of it as Picasso sort of picks the right woman for the right moment and the right style in his life. When he's in the neoclassical period, it's Olga, his beautiful ballet russe ballerina from Diaghilev's ballet. And And then so he has dancers and the beautiful human form, the perfect human form, the ideal human form. But then he begins chafing against Olga's bourgeois aspirations, and he breaks free and finds Marie-Thérèse Walter, the beautiful, voluptuous blonde from the 1930s works. She is the embodiment not only of nature, physicality, sexuality, but she's also the embodiment of surrealism.
And then there are stories like the young 17-and-a-half-year-old whom he takes and shows a Japanese work of his art because she'd never heard of him and didn't seem to have the intellectual. And then there's the story about the woman with the glove who became his lover and the knife. In fact, I think you brought a poem on that. Tell us that.
I did, and it's fascinating.
I'm being obscure here, but I don't mean to be. Go back to the story about the 17-and-a-half-year-old.
No, absolutely. Marie-Thérèse Walter was 17-and-a-half years old when Picasso met her outside the Galerie Lafayette department store in Paris, where she was shopping for a Peter Pan collar. And he walked up to her and said, "I'm Picasso. I want to paint you. We're going to do great things together," which sounded really wonderful, except she had never heard of him, which is rather extraordinary. He was already the most famous artist in the world. He took her down the street in his come up and see my etchings moment and went to a bookstore. And the only book on Picasso in the store was in Japanese language. But he showed it to her. The seduction was successful, shall we say. And she became his mistress and muse for the next decade. However, she was replaced. We were talking about how Picasso finds the right woman for the right time. For the Spanish Civil War years and the World War II years, that model, mistress and muse, is Dora Maar, who was a great intellect, a very accomplished surrealist photographer, friends with Man Ray and André Breton and other great surrealists. And she seduces Picasso. She turns the tables. They're in a cafe in Paris. He's sitting across the way. She knows who he is. She takes a steak knife on the table of the cafe and starts jabbing it into the table between her gloved hands. She misses several times, so she's bleeding onto the gloves. Picasso was completely entranced by this woman who was edgy, shall we say. He actually kept those gloves as an encounter of one of their first meetings to the end of his life as a sort of fetish. He's wrote a poem about this experience. It's very short. I want to read it. Very few people realize that the poets of the Surrealist period considered Picasso a major poet. So this is the knife in this is about this experience. Tongue of fire that fans her face and fear that smiles, a knife that jumps for joy. Right now, this very day left floating, however it likes, every which way. At this precise, necessary moment, at the summit of the well, a scream of the rose, the hand cast down like a little alms.
That's really quite good.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And notice the alms at the end. You mentioned Picasso and Spain, and immediately yesterday, in the very first room of the exhibition, you brought up how essential and important it is that he's Catholic. He is from Andalusia. He's from the hotbed of machismo in Spain. He's born in 1881, which at this point, so to speak, is 3 centuries ago, but over 100 years ago. And this is a deep rooted part of his sensibility is to set up polarities and extremes, life and death, that women are doormats or goddesses. I mean, these are things he actually said and thought, and they're apparent in his work. So he disposes his women and himself on and in his works of art almost as if it's a theatrical stage and they are the players upon it.
Did he deserve the misogynist label that has become so identified with him, thanks in part to people like Arianna Huffington, actually, among others?
Absolutely. I think that is part of this psychobiography phenomenon. I think what's interesting is I mentioned Warhol earlier as the more recent famous and accomplished and influential artist. He was also accused of this as well, that if, you know, this sort of vortex of the factory in New York.
Well, he got shot for it.
Exactly. Svengali lured people, men and women, in and so forth. I think what you learn from Picasso, I just mentioned Dora Maar seducing Picasso and the way he seduced Marie-Thérèse Walter, that it's often a two-way street. It does take two. And in addition to his picking women that he needed or wanted for a particular style or moment in his life, a certain kind of experience privately or professionally or out in the world, they too were also gravitating to Picasso as this charismatic, forceful, powerful, talented person. And of course, they got great sustenance from that experience as well, including being the subject of one of the great artists in the history of art.
Including a woman who he ran after saying, "You've made the biggest mistake of your life," and she winds up, "You can't do better than me," and she winds up with Jonas Salk.
That's exactly right. François Gillot, in some sense, is the one who was, like Dora Maar, exceptionally intelligent, an artist in her own right, mother of Claude and Paloma with Picasso. But indeed, she leaves leaves him, and as she's sort of driving off, he says, "You'll nothing without me, and you'll never meet anyone great." And then she marries the inventor of the polio vaccine. There's a very moving painting in the exhibition that's about her departure, in which she is depicted, now that she's gone, as a beautiful nude odalisque reclining on their bed in their bedroom horizontally, but vertically she appears as the nude odalisque on his canvas. She is his subject and his model. And then very poignantly, up in the corner is Claude's little toy horse and cart, a reminder of the children he's now lost. And then silhouetted and superimposed over the whole is a black outline silhouette of Picasso, who is in mourning for his great loss.
You do see so much of these women in so much of his work. Olga in an armchair, I can't get that picture out of it. It was done in 1918, which is such a beautiful rendering. And she indeed was quite beautiful in here. But let's get back to the whole psychobiographical question for a moment, because I was struck, for example, by the fact that, as anyone who has studied Picasso knows, he was strongly influenced by African art. And yet, when he was asked about that, he was never heard of it, basically, was his response. Sometimes you really can't trust the artist in terms of, well, telling you about what influenced the artist in life or, for that matter, in terms of other art.
You're
in fact, many
right.
times you can't trust the artist.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. Picasso actually told an interviewer, "Don't ask questions because it will just encourage me to tell lies." But you're absolutely right. I mean, the transformative experience of his entire life and career was a visit to the Museum of Man in the Trocadero in Paris, where he encountered ethnographic art, so-called, for the first time. And it's interesting because other artists were already collecting it. Matisse and Durand already had African art sculptures. But he goes there and he says, "It was dark and musty and dusty. I wanted to leave, but I stayed and I learned." And I want to read a quote, the only quote you really need to know to understand Picasso. He said about African art, "Men had made those masks and other objects for a sacred purpose, a magic purpose, as a kind of mediation between themselves and the unknown hostile forces that surrounded them in order to overcome their fear and horror by giving it a form and an image. At that moment, I realized this was what painting was all about. It's not an aesthetic operation. It's a form of magic designed as a mediator between this strange, hostile world and us, a way of seizing the power by giving form to our terrors as well as our desires. When I came to that realization, I knew I'd found my way."
And this is where you can believe Picasso. I mean, because
exactly.
you see his work almost as talismanic or as having that kind of exorcism quality or magic. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the work from the particularly striking. It's not necessarily his best work, but the work during World War II, it's in some ways the darkest and most despairing work. And one thinks, of course, of Guernica, but mm-hmm. other work that he produced during that period. There's a picture, for example, of and I found myself thinking of it over and over again, of a cat taking mm-hmm. a bird. And you were talking about this as maybe Picasso seeing the likelihood of what was happening to his beloved Spain. And in many of those paintings during the war period, seeing what was happening to Europe from Picasso's point of view. Of course, you know, you look at a painting like that and you say, maybe it was just a cat with a bird too, right?
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. And people who visit the De Young Museum to see the masterpieces from Picasso will notice that the war years, both the Spanish Civil War and World War II, are in gray galleries. This is an attempt to evoke the dark period of the war. For Picasso, first and foremost, he's always a Spaniard. He was actually offered citizenship late in life. He was so French citizenship. He was so furious, he actually picked up the tablecloth and threw the whole dinner over the balcony. He was always, always, always a Spaniard at heart and very loyal to the Republican cause in Spain. And Guernica, very famously, as you mentioned, painted in support of it, and he even sold prints to help raise money for the Republican war effort. So what happens, though, is people forget that as a Spanish national living in France without French citizenship, that he is vulnerable. Franco, of course, hates him for Guernica and for his public stance as a Republican. The Nazis invade France and occupy Paris. And so suddenly he could be deported to Spain, where he could be arrested or shot or imprisoned or taken by the Gestapo. And French right-wing artists actually accuse Picasso of being Jewish just to try to get him in trouble with the Nazis. So what he begins to do is to craft these metaphorical, symbolic works where he hides his overt political feelings and messages because he has to. He has to conceal them because he's vulnerable. The painting you refer to is indeed painted in the last weeks of the Spanish Civil War. Franco is victorious. He's sort of cleaning up in Spain. The Republicans are defeated. And so it's this vicious-looking cat with all his claws out toying with this wounded bird. It is Franco toying with the dead Republican free Spain.
Makes me think of somebody like Art Spiegelman. I mean, what's exactly. done, again, anthropomorphically in that way. And when you talk about the magical quality of art or the art having a life of its own, this is why he eschewed the whole idea of frames for quite a while.
It's one of the striking aspects of the exhibition is that they have these travel frames to protect them when they went on their world tour. But in fact, Picasso never framed works of art. He said to frame a painting is to kill it. He, of all people, especially through Cuban, is one of the great artists who sort of broke down the barriers between the real world and the realm of art, very famously by introducing collage, newspapers or papier-collé, and then an assemblage, bringing actual wood or fragments from the real world into his works. Once you've dissolved that barrier between art and life through his work, the last thing he wants to do is put a frame around it, sort of reviving and resuscitating and excavating that Renaissance trope of the picture frame being a window onto nature.
You're saying deep down he's really a figurative artist, aren't you?
He absolutely is. You mentioned earlier his tendency to anthropomorphize. There are works in the exhibition, very beautiful tabletop still life of a ceramic vase with two apples perched on top and two more apples on the table. It will immediately remind everyone of Cézanne from our Musée d'Orsay exhibition, those great tabletop still lifes. But the fruit is anthropomorphic. You feel that they're alive. The vase is a beautiful sort of stand-in for the female form with all its curvature of the hips and so forth. This is very much like his guitars, which very famously are also stand-ins for the female form. He actually published a journal in Madrid in 1901 in which there was an article called The Physiology of the Guitar that likens the guitar not only in its physical form to women, but metaphorically and symbolically, and that the artist could, quote-unquote, play the guitar with all the sexual and physical overtones that would have as well.
Albeit sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Exactly.
Both Judy Campbell and I, who saw the exhibit yesterday, were struck by that figure, those two, the painting of those two figures on the beach. Talk about that, because it brings a lot to life, really.
It is one of the great icons of 20th century art. Two Women Running on the Beach from 1922 is from his neoclassical period, and they look like Greek figures wearing toga-like white forms, dresses, and they're just tearing across this beach at full speed with passion and sort of forward movement, and yet there's this incredible stillness about it at the same time.
He reminds me of Keats's Grecian Urn a bit. I mean, with that sense of motion at the same time that it's stasis.
Absolutely. It's more compelling, I think, when you have that kind of stasis and motion combined, because it's held in this precarious balance and could sort of implode or explode at any moment. Picasso, of course, this is the neoclassical period when he's with Olga the ballerina, and he's beginning to sort of chafe against her bourgeois aspirations. I always see this painting as proto-surrealist, that it is this desire to break free, and it's one of the great kinesthetic paintings of all time. Their outstretched limbs actually are physically bigger, so he's not trying to show you what it looks like to run, but what it feels like when your limbs feel heavier and so forth. They're basically maenads. They're the sort of the Dionysian Bacchanalian revel. Picasso, of course, was always Bacchus, and they would drink and lose all their inhibitions, and of course, this is the great paradigm of surrealism itself, is to cast off all of society's conventions and conformity and embrace the subconscious, the unconscious, and deeper hidden desires.
Yeah, one of the funniest things about the new Woody Allen film, I don't want to give anything away, but the guy comes from the future to Paris in the 20s, and he says, I'm from the future. He tells us to the surrealists, and they don't even blink an eye because they just assume that, no, he's from the future. Okay. Exactly. We're talking to Timothy Englund-Burgard, who's from the de Young Museum. He's a curator of American art there, and he's a curator of the Picasso exhibit, and it is an exhibit really well worth seeing, to put it mildly. More than 100 extraordinary works on display. You are welcome to join us in conversation about Picasso, about his work, if you've seen the exhibit, or complimentary works, over at the MoMA in the Gertrude Stein Matisse Picasso exhibit. We're really talking about Picasso this hour and your responses to the great artist and to his times and to, well, Picasso's work as well. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. Tomorrow on Forum, in our second hour, author Ann Patchett will join me in studio. Her new novel is called State of Wonder. You can listen to past Forum shows and join the discussion on this segment and others by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on the show you want to comment on. And you can always share your show ideas by emailing forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing Pablo Picasso and the more than 100 extraordinary works that are on display at the De Young Museum in San Francisco. The exhibit is on loan from the permanent collection of Paris Musée National Picasso while the museum is closed for renovations. And if you have some thoughts about Picasso, if you care to join us, you can do that a number of ways. In fact, masterpieces, some of them are online and you can look at them. Some of the paintings we've been talking about here and some of the works that are available to you at the De Young exhibit simply by going to kqed.org and looking at some that we have posted for you, including Running on the Beach one that I alluded to, as well as The Cat Chasing a Bird, Olga in an Armchair, just to name a few that we have talked about, but it's a really nice selection. And you can feel free to join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 if you have something you'd like to ask or say about Picasso. We welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website at kqed.org/forum and click on the segment. I should mention that there are also some wonderful quotes as you go through this exhibit, Picasso quotes. I like a number of them and found myself lost in some of those quotes as well. What's your favorite?
My Timothy? Favorite is, art is a lie that makes us realize the truth.
I kind of like, art is never chased.
Art is never chased is a good one, too.
Yeah. See that old
is anything really?
Well, yeah. Chase makes waste. It was one of the 60s buttons. We're going to go to your calls and emails here in just a moment. I wanted to announce, though, that there's been really a major gift to the Stanford Art Museum that you may have read about. It was a cover story in today's Chronicle. I saw Ken Baker, the Chronicle art critic, last night, and he said, big surprise tomorrow. We've got an exclusive. It's a front-page story. And indeed it is, because 121 paintings from the collection of Harry and Margaret Anderson of Atherton, including a famous painting by Jackson Pollock called Lucifer, were donated. But there are Rothkos and Motherwells and de Koonings. It's really quite a quite an exceptional contribution to the Stanford Art Museum. Just a word from you on this, Timothy. I mean, this is really all kind of contributing a greater enhancement of the San Francisco Bay Area as really an art center in contemporary and modern art.
Absolutely. Everyone who knows and loves the Bay Area and its museums can look back over even just the last 10 years alone, let alone 20 or so, and think how extraordinary the renovation of SF MoMA, the opening of the new De Young Museum and the renovation of our Legion of Honor, the Fisher loan agreement with SF MoMA, now the Anderson gift with Stanford. These are extraordinary accomplishments for the Bay Area that have really helped to make San Francisco a very significant, not only museum capital, but art capital.
Before we go to callers, one final thing, because so many people associate Picasso with Cubism, and we were talking about the Gertrude Stein exhibits, and we were talking about the split between Gertrude and her brother over sort of taking sides on Cubism and against Cubism, Gertrude Stein having been, of course, the great supporter of Picasso's, and her brother being not necessarily a great supporter of Picasso's. But I realized to what degree, and of course, this is always kind of something I've gleaned in my consciousness, but looking at some of those extraordinary works you have in your exhibit at the De Young, how much Cubism is a collaborative effort on the part of the person who's looking at the painting.
Absolutely. And I mentioned Picasso sort of introducing the element of time into these works, multiple perspectives at multiple discrete moments in time. And this is, once you realize that perception is contingent, then in a sense, so is reality and maybe even truth. But you've absolutely identified one of the key ingredients of modernism as we know it, which Picasso originated, which is he's essentially, with Cubist works, given you all the components for a Cubist construction, as it were. You have to visually reassemble, say, the guitar player in the cafe or whatever the scene might be. And so the concept of the viewer completing the work of art and actually having to work at it is one of the central tenets of modernism. Picasso actually said about these Cubist paintings, you could actually cut them up according to their colored planes and make a fully three-dimensional sculpture, which is really an extraordinary concept. And of course, then he creates Cubist sculpture as well.
Well, here's someone who got a little bit exercised. Bob from Sonoma writes, Warhol, what the hell is your guest talking about? Picasso was an artistic genius. Warhol was talented as a PR practitioner and a cynical one at that, the greatest fraud in the history of the art world, or rather art market. What do you really think, Bob?
Exactly. Don't hold back.
No, I mean, yeah. There are people who get upset when you use Picasso and Warhol in the same breath because they're such advocates of Warhol.
Absolutely. No. I mean, it cuts both ways. And you know, all opinions about art are subjective. I was rather astounded by the commentary on the announcement of the Stanford gift that about 90% of the comments were that Pollock was a fraud, that Jackson Pollock was a fraud. What I will say is a very important distinction. I have opinions about everything. We all do. But what I said was, Picasso was the most influential artist of the first half of the 20th century. And I think personally, subjectively, granted, that Warhol's the most influential artist of the second
half.
Well,
in conceptual art.
Whether you like it or not is up to everyone's own discretion and opinion and, you know, informed and hopefully always informed. But I think, you know, when we look as a museum and as a curator and as art historians, we all try to look at what is culturally significant in a given era rather than trying to pick and choose winners or investing in the art market. That's not my job. It's not our job. Our job is to try to be more objective and sort of let history sort everything out, but make them available, accessible, and hopefully sort of elucidated and illuminated when we present objects and exhibitions to the public.
A lot of people also make this dividing line between those artists who are commercially successful or are maybe doing some promotion and marketing that allows them to be even more commercially successful, as opposed to maybe the idea of the real artist, the bohemian, you know, suffering with cockroaches and, you know, not able to eat except for crumbs. I mean, the fact is that Picasso was very rich in his later years. I mean, quite affluent as a result of his work. And, well, let me go to our callers and see what they have to say and bring to the table here. Max, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much, as usual, for a very good program. One quick comment and one quick question. I visited the Musée Picasso in the Marais. I was simply astounded, as you expressed very well, by the man's output. And then my question is this. Can you guess, comment about Picasso's friendship with prominent artists and writers, specifically Wilfredo Lam of Cuba and Aimé Césaire of France and Martinique? As a matter of fact, they are having an exposition right now on that last subject. Thank you. I'll take your comments on the air.
All right. Thank you, Max.
Well, absolutely. Just in the way that Picasso was an omnivore for all of art, he also was famous from day one in Barcelona in a very avant-garde bohemian community, his tertulia in Barcelona. He always had the band Picasso, you know, Picasso band around him in Paris as well, artists, writers, musicians, poets. He consistently was supportive, especially of younger artists. You mentioned Lam a moment ago. The difficulty comes in, of course. An artist like Juan Gris would come to Paris broke, impoverished, and Spanish. Picasso would help him always. He was very generous. But when Gris began to get the same comparable kinds of accolades that Picasso did, then he would move on to other more younger, more helpless, less formed artists. He was extraordinarily generous, and John Richardson, his famous biographer, now three volumes and counting, describes scenes in which he saw Picasso at a table surrounded by other famous poets and writers. He had a poet for every period of his career. It was Max Jacob in the beginning, Cocteau in the neoclassical period, and André Breton in the Surrealist period. He described this extraordinary...
And Apollinaire, too.
Yeah. Apollinaire, exactly, during Cubism. He described a scene in which Picasso would, like a vacuum, just absorb in a sponge, pull all the energy from the room, and then he would abruptly get up from the table, go to his studio, and pour it forth onto the canvas.
We'll pour forth some more of your calls. Rick, you're on. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning. I just wanted to say that in my humble opinion, having seen those marvelous movies of Picasso creating in his studio when I was a boy growing up, that he is, it seems to me, he's incredibly derivative of he's more of a genius popularizer than a real innovator. Is that fair to say? I mean, I'm very curious to know what your guest says.
Picasso as synthesizer.
Well, I think synthesizer is certainly fair, but no, I would have to disagree. I think I'm sort of interested by how many preconceptions we all have about Picasso, and I'm including myself because I got to spend the last week in the exhibition installing the works, which was a great lesson to me about how diverse his works are. Having said that, and having had my own preconceptions throughout my life about his work, he's always more diverse and more interesting and more complex than I first thought. And I would say, on the contrary, I would defer here to all of his artists, poets, writers, musician friends, to a man and woman. They all accorded Picasso the identity and the honor of being the great progenitor of multiple major art movements, Cubism and Surrealism and the Blue and Rose periods and so forth, and others that he inspired. It's very interesting. I think Picasso often provided the keys to these movements, but he didn't open all the doors himself. He never crossed over, for example, into abstraction, but he gave permission for everyone else to cross over into abstraction.
In fact, there's a painting with keys that sort of dovetails with what you're saying.
Exactly.
What
right.
is that painting called?
That's a beach scene of figures on a beach where a figure is turning the key in a cabana door. This is one of the great surrealist paintings of his career and a work that is very much about the Freud and Jungian ideas of unlocking the subconscious.
We thank the caller, and we go on to Sunnyvale. John, join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Picasso said that he painted like Raphael at age 10, but took the rest of his life to paint like a child. And I wonder what that might have meant to Picasso and what it means to your guest to take the rest of your life to paint like a child. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one
this
of the
is
wonder-
the Blakeyan child we're talking about.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. No, absolutely. And that is one of the quotes on the wall in the exhibition that Michael mentioned a moment ago. It's fascinating, first of all, because the first part is a lie. Picasso said he could paint like Raphael when he was 10. We have his works from when he was 10. His first painting at age 10, by the way, was a bullfight, very tellingly, for the great Spaniard artist. But he was not Raphael. On the other hand, by the time he's 20, he's pretty extraordinary. What I would say about it is that what in the post-war years, Picasso is seen as passé, retardataire, outmoded, abstract expressionism has risen to the fore. We were just talking about Jackson Pollock a moment ago. And Picasso has been swept aside as irrelevant. He's had his day. He was the great progenitor of Cubism, one of the great contributors of Surrealism. But he's now, the younger generation has usurped his rightful place. What I think we see in retrospect is in the post-war period when the human form and humanity itself was threatened with absolute outright distinction in the Holocaust, the trenches of World War II, the atomic bomb, I think Picasso deserves a lot of credit in retrospect for sustaining, reviving, and revitalizing the human form and humanism. I mentioned he's really the great humanist artist of the 20th century in that respect, in an era when abstraction sort of ruled across the board with curators, critics, and collectors. characters. So I would say in that late decade or two of his career, he does indeed paint like a child in the same way that Matisse painted like a child. They both took great inspiration from their own children and watching them draw without editing, without sort of looking at the history of art, without overthinking, you know, the overthought or overwrought work of art. And he goes for broke. All of a sudden, he's a living old master. He knows he's in his last decade of his life, and he can just paint anything he wants, any way he wants. And it is not a coincidence when they showed these light works at the Guggenheim Museum in New York in 1983 that the neo-expressionist artists Basquiat, Schnabel, Clemente went to that exhibition and were completely mesmerized by his sheer ability and his force of will to create something out of nothing with paint, and paint in the most beautiful, beautiful, extraordinary, moving way.
Well, what's that painting in the later part where he's got Matisse in there and then he's got an empty blank canvas?
Matisse was Picasso's one true equal. He looked at him slightly as a father figure. He was slightly older. Picasso's own father was a painter as well. Matisse dies in 1953 and a couple of years, 54, I'm sorry. In 1956, Picasso paints the scene in his own studio in the south of France. On the floor are two canvases, one with a Matissean woman and the other with a Picasso monochrome. The other one's very colorful, a monochrome Picasso triangle cubistic head. On the easel in the center of the room is a completely blank canvas. There is nothing more terrifying to an artist than a blank canvas, just as for a writer, a blank sheet of paper. But this is his tribute to his friendship with Matisse. He said, when one of us is gone, we'll never be able to have the conversations we have with each other. He also said, in the end, there's only Matisse. He started giving him the accolade. And then very wonderfully, he said, when Matisse died, he left me his Odalisque and his legacy, like he'd left him his nudes and his will. And so this empty canvas is a beautiful, passionate, moving tribute to the fact that never again will a Matisse be painted.
Our guest is De Young Museum curator Timothy Englund-Burgard. And since we're, for the sake of symmetry here, you were talking about that early bullfight representation of Picasso. As you get into the later period, and in fact, it's in the selection that we have on our website, if you go to it, at kqed.org, from the exhibit at the De Young, there's a bull's head that he did out of a bicycle saddle. What was this, like
1942?
Right
in the middle of World War
II. Middle of the war, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And did this with handlebars. You know?
Absolutely. He found a cast-off handlebars and bicycle seat. He used to joke that he hoped one day this work would be discarded. Unlikely, of course. It's a Picasso. And that a little boy would come along and find and say, oh, how great, a bicycle seat and handlebars. I can fix my bicycle. He made this bull's head the quintessential symbol of Spain and the bullfight during the World War II years. And therefore, it has all the associations of Spanish Republican Free Spain and, of course, resistance. Picasso often depicts himself as the bull or the minotaur. That's sort of his surrogate for his sort of bestial urges and passions. And in this case, I think it's very moving because here's Picasso living under the threat of arrest by the Nazis during the occupation of World War II. And I've read descriptions of this era. There were no cars in the streets because there was no gasoline. The Germans requisitioned everything. The only cars were SS limousines and troop carriers, trucks. And so everyone moved around the city on their bicycles, including members of the resistance, people like Jean Moulin. And so I always felt that not only is it the symbol of Spain and the symbol of the bull, Picasso, but that it embodies this, as it were, passive but firm and strong resistance to the Nazi occupation.
In fact, the work right after the Blitzkrieg, 1939, I mean, which was certainly anticipated, is very dark. And Picasso clearly really wrestling with evil and doing so on his canvas. But I want to get back to that something almost the antithesis of that, and that is that childlike quality that we were talking mm-hmm. about that Picasso was striving for and has said in so many instances he wanted to create. Reminds me, I went through the letters of Sal Bello, and he was talking about a moment when he saw sandals as a child and just the excitement of the particular sandals that he knew his mother was going to buy for him that he would put on his feet and so forth. I think at least in my own sense, that maybe that's a lot of what Picasso is talking about, just looking with wonder and looking with the kind of boyhood fascination and delight and the kind of innocence maybe that that all suggests.
It's absolutely right. I think on some fundamental level for all artists, to be an artist is to perpetuate a state of childhood, and it includes that sense of wonder, that sense of curiosity, and that ability to see things anew over and over again rather than seeing them through our preconceptions. He did have that extraordinary sense of self, and it's very important, just as he spoke about African art as being like magic and being mediators between us and the unknown forces of the world, everything Picasso does comes from a deeply rooted emotional place in his psyche. It is never an empty intellectual exercise. And this is the great sort of lie of cubism with the millions of followers. There have probably been more bad cubist paintings made, except perhaps for abstract expressionism, than any other art movement in history, because people thought, well, all you have to do is superimpose a grid and break it down into little cubes and trapezoids and geometric forms. Picasso is coming from a completely different place that is that childlike sense of wonder that, like the surrealist said, we think what we see is normal, and you think our paintings or our poems or our music are strange and odd, but they're no more strange and odd than what we see every day. And then you look at our own dreams, of course, and there it all is. We see all of those things with equal value and equal fascination.
And again, you can see some of the paintings we're talking about, as well as some of the slides of paintings and work from the Picasso exhibit by going to kqed.org/forum. And right on point here, I think, we're going to Tom in San Francisco. Tom, join us. Hi.
Hi. This is a really fantastic show. I was an art history major at Stanford many years ago and took a Picasso class from Al Elson, who was really the key to getting the Anderson collection and the Rodin collection to Stanford. So it's really great that his legacy still lives on. But my question about the Picasso exhibition is, it seems like there's a troubling trend where the space in the Legion of Honor is this kind of black hole for scholarship, with the Egyptian exhibition, with the Impressionism exhibition. The one thing I haven't heard the curator talk about, and maybe it's because he's an American curator of art, maybe that's why he talks about Warhol, is what new scholarship is being done with this exhibition. I mean, I think it's wonderful to go and see all these works together, and you can learn a lot by looking, but the real role of a museum is also to do scholarship, and I feel like the young more and more is tending towards these blockbusters that are attractive, but they don't really do any new scholarship. For instance, one question I'd like him to ask is what exhibition going to that space will originate from the De Young? What sort of new scholarship is coming out of the De Young? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. And actually, Jerry from San Rafael, dovetailing with that question, says, curious question about your guest. He's a curator of American art at the De Young and yet curating the Picasso show. Is it just me or is this curious?
Well, I won't argue on any of those points. But in fact, I've published several articles on Picasso. So it actually is a particular area of interest of mine. We all get
assigned. Shows that you're a man of many colors.
Or something, yes. Yeah. We all get assigned labels that may or may not fit. But I have read extensively about Picasso and published on him. And Picasso's had more literature than almost any artist in the history of art, as we all know.
What about that new scholarship, though? I mean, is that an expectation?
Yeah, no. And there are essays in the exhibition catalog, indeed, by the director, who is a very renowned scholar of Picasso herself, and all the curators, the curator of paintings, the curator of prints, and so forth. There is new scholarship on Picasso every day. I would say that this installation, which I think is one of the most beautiful installations that has appeared at the De Young, we worked with the director of the Musée Picasso for the entire week to install the exhibition. And it is really weighted to having this aesthetic experience as a counterpoint to the truly aisles and aisles of library books on Picasso's and the voluminous articles. I wrote one with 140 footnotes. I know what those are like. And they serve a place and a point, but I think Anne Baldessari, the director of the Musée Picasso, felt very strongly about having an aesthetic experience in this exhibition. And then the catalog has the scholarship. I do want to address the blockbuster issue because it's very much on everyone's minds. Any big museum has to deal with this issue. And while it deserves a show unto itself, I do want to make the point that about 82% of Americans do not own a passport. So they have no ability to go to Paris or other great cities, to the Musée d'Orsay or to the Musée Picasso, to see truly great works of art. And as someone who, as a graduate student, you know, lived on a $10-a-day budget, I know what this feels like. And the sort of opportunity and the extraordinary experience to walk into the Metropolitan Museum in New York or the De Young here and see a truly great exhibition of art, whether it be African or Oceanic or American or European, is really essential for an artist's evolution and for their understanding, as it is for all of us. And I think it really serves a role in the community that's often overlooked. It may indeed be that scholarship is sometimes relegated to the catalogs. I will say, however, the greatest scholarship ever created on Picasso is by Picasso himself. This is an exhibition that not only has the iconic masterpieces we've been discussing, but the working drawings leading up to them. And this is where you see the eye and hand and mind of a truly great artist at work, puzzling out, thinking out, looking like a child, thinking like an adult, synthesizing, distilling, and then arriving at the finished masterpiece that we all know and love. This is one of the great experiences of this exhibition, is to see what he thinks about them, not just what some scholar writes about them.
Well, I want to put a plug in here for Norman Mailer's book on Picasso, which I interviewed him on when soon after it was published, one of the interviews we did together, which I think it's not a scholarly book, but, you know, it's a book by someone who's clearly quite visionary and extraordinarily knowledgeable and really does his homework and is very solid in doing homework when he takes on a task, whatever it may be. Let me go to more of your calls. In the meantime, Michael, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the earlier callers mentioned that Picasso might not have been original. I know that maybe Braque invented collage before Picasso, and maybe Gonzalez invented constructed sculpture before Picasso, but he obviously took advantage of those. But he was incredibly original and fecund, and I think I'd like to have your guest comment on what I think is one of the most important lessons in the 20th century in art, is what Picasso learned from African art, that he learned, and this is a secret to his productivity, I think, he learned that the importance of art is not in the art object itself, that we live in a world of forms, and if there are inner mysteries that swirl around in our being, and we have no form to give them, we'll be haunted and troubled by those mysteries. And that he knew that when we gave a form to these inner mysteries, it gave us power, it liberated us from the nightmares, and it gave us the ability to have a handle on that problem. It's out in front of us now. We can look at it. We can change it. We can transmogrify it. We can use it to solve the problems we have with our lovers, to solve our fear, deal with our fears and the unknown. And so that he didn't care how much how the watercolor hit the paper. He knew that by giving birth to these new images, transforming them, he gained in liberation and freedom and power, and he exulted in that, I think.
I think that's well said. Do you agree, Timothy?
It's absolutely spot on. And yes, he's absolutely right. Braque gets credit for the first papier collé, but as usual, Picasso runs with it. Picasso, on the other hand, did the first sort of true assemblage. And yes, Gonzalez taught him to weld sculpture, so that's one of his great contributions. And then again, how many people remember Gonzalez, who's a marvelous sculptor, but do remember Picasso's sculptures? So there's a very beautiful sculpture in the exhibition that was a proposal for a monument to Guillaume Apollinaire, the great poet you mentioned earlier, is one of Picasso's closest friends in the Cubist period. Never realized, but that sculpture is a sculpture he made with Gonzalez learning to weld for the first time.
Let me thank the caller. Let's see if we can get a final call on, and that's you, Pierre. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Wonderful talk show and a wonderful show, I am sure. I saw these pieces several times, once, of course, twice actually, in Paris and the Picasso Museum, and once in Seattle, but I would like to see it again, because a show is always interpreted by the curator. It's like a Beethoven sonata is not the same and played by Schnabel or by Alfred Bendel and so on. So it is Picasso interpreted by the curator. Two little comments. One is that this man seems to have ever stopped working. Just amazing how the output, just the quantity alone. The second is that, it was not mentioned specifically, is that he also doesn't seem to have ever taken himself entirely seriously. There is always a whimsical touch in almost everything.
Pierre, I'm so glad you said that, because I think we're in agreement on that as well, and it's a good place to conclude here. Three cheers for the curator of this exhibit, by the way. In fact, we've got some great exhibits here in San Francisco and throughout the Bay Area. Avail yourself of them. The Dieng Museum hosting an exhibition of Pablo Picasso's work, really representing his whole career. Thank you so much, Timothy Englund-Burgard.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have had you. And thank you, our listeners, and thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll. And reminder that you can get the slideshow on the web simply by going to kqed.org/forum and seeing the pieces we put up there for you. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.